Welcome back to the program. The spirit that infused young people in the 1960s may be a distant memory, but today a new generation lives in hope of making the world a better place. Whether they have the political skills, the commitment, or the clarity to succeed is still an open question. Clearly, if we look around the world, the Arab Spring proves that protest as a political force is still very much alive, that it can tear down walls and topple dictators. But here in America, the forces allied against change and hope and progress may simply be too strong. So what's a young activist to do? We're going to talk about that today with a man who truly understands the role of an activist. He is Todd Gitlin. He's a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. He himself was truly an activist in the 1960s and made a profound difference. He's written 14 books, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here today to talk about the reissue of his book, Letters to a Young Activist. Todd Gitlin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. You originally wrote this back in, I think, 2003. Talk a little bit about what's changed in terms of the role of an activist.
Well, nothing, actually, in my view. The role of an activist is a fixture. That is, there's always a need for people to function on the outside of the political system, on the outside of the cultural order. That's where the energy comes from. That's where the, to use a current buzzword, entrepreneurship comes from, the innovation, the spirit of renewal. There always need to be revitalization movements when institutions calcify, and they do, when political classes discredit themselves, as this one has. And what activists do, I mean, activism is a, so once you decide you're an activist, that only opens up a whole slew of questions. What do you do, and who are your potential allies, and what are your goals, intermediate, short-term, what are your tactics, and so on. You always need to be thinking on your feet as an activist, but there's always the need for the outsider who busts into the party and says, actually, we the people are the source of democratic legitimacy or the source of legitimate authority in a democratic society. And the rules which have proceeded so far benefit the imposers, the imposters, the hijackers of the democratic promise. So make way for new blood.
How important is it that there be clarity for the role of the activist in terms of what he or she is trying to accomplish?
I think it is quite important. Activism I see as a craft, and just as if you're building a piece of furniture or building a radio kit tinkering with a car, you need to know what you're doing. I mean, you need to know what supplies you need. You need to know what tools you need. You need to think clearly. I think that's activism springs from a passion and from values, properly so. But you might just as well say, "Well, I'm going to build me a cabinet by wishing it because I passionately wish to have a cabinet in front of me." No, you actually have to know what you're doing.
But at the end of that process, there is the cabinet. With respect to activism, sometimes the end product, the end result, isn't that clear going in? Sometimes there are unintended consequences and sometimes unintended results, both positive and negative.
Well said. And this is something, you know, this is the existential fulcrum of activism. It's a given, and this is why, yeah, it is actually more difficult than building a cabinet. You need to make wise estimates of the probabilities of different sorts of outcomes when there are no blueprints. There are no guarantees. There is no blueprint. And situations change. As you build what you're building, others are building to counter it. And I mean, we saw this very clearly in the 1960s when the beneficiary of, at least in the short run, of a lot of the energies that were unleashed by the new left were the right. So you need to be constantly readjusting your sights in the light of what's coming to pass. You have to actually face reality, and that means that you're constantly recalibrating. This is a considerable intellectual as well as moral challenge.
Mm-hmm. When one thinks of it in terms of the 1960s, and maybe it's just because hindsight is always so much easier, when we think of the clarity of the battles against Vietnam, rights for women, the civil rights movement, obviously, and even the things laid out clearly in things like the Port Huron Statement, there seemed to be more clarity in terms of what the objects of the activism were.
That's true, although there was a grandeur or a grandiosity, if you like, to many of the early statements that were not quite so concrete. I mean, what we call today the civil rights movement, for example, didn't generally refer to itself that way. It referred to itself as the freedom movement, and that wasn't exactly a cut-and-dried, detailed description of what it was about. It was something of a spirit, and it was indeed true at times that there was a great deal of clarity about what the movement wanted. And certainly the anti-war movement had no trouble specifying what it wanted. It wanted them to leave, and wanted the troops to leave Vietnam. And when the question cropped up, well, then what? How can you remove them? The answer was on boats. So today, you know, if you consider, for example, the Occupy movement, which I've written another book about that's just about to come out called Occupy Nation. This is a movement which has a very grand objective of curbing plutocratic power, and famously was reluctant, or in fact opposed to specifying what it wanted. I think that in order to continue the momentum that it built up last year, it does need to be more specific about short-term, middle-term, long-term demands. It needs to be talking about driving money out of politics. It needs to be talking about taxing Wall Street transactions. It needs to be talking about progressivity in taxes and so on. So, yes, I do think that concreteness is an obligation. Because the movement aims to embody the values of a lot of people who are not in the movement and don't necessarily understand it. So you are obliged to take your audience seriously and to take into account their understandings of the world.
It also does seem that activism, to be successful, also has to take into account the full measure of the opponent, of what the other side looks like. It's very different in a situation, for example, like in Egypt or even in the 60s, as opposed to going against plutocratic power today.
Well, actually, no, I would offer a different view of what happened in Egypt. The movement that entered into Tahrir Square in January of 2011 made a strategic decision at one point, which enabled them to drive Mubarak from power. They made the decision to ally themselves with the army. And aligning themselves with the army when the police were withdrawn meant that they were, it was harder to open fire on them. Because after all, the army was drawn from the common people. Now, in the mid run, as we've seen, making a tactical alliance with the army also entailed dangers. And those are the dangers that the activists of that movement now contend with. And that's politics. I mean, you don't get to redefine the landscape just as you like. You have to take the measure of the forces that actually exist. You have to size them up. You have to appraise the battlefield without illusion, without romance. And that means driving a wedge into elites in power, trying to break them up and to form complicated alliances which may not be eternal, but which are necessary. That's all difficult work, and it's mandatory.
On the other side of it, it seems that it should be somewhat easier, and I put that in quotes, to create a kind of horizontal movement, which most of these movements are, in this age of technology and social networking and everything that goes along with it.
Up to a point. I mean, I think, again, to talk about Occupy for a moment, the genius of the movement last year was that it fused online organizing with face-to-face, traditional community building, here we are, let's talk together organizing. It was the combination of the two. You can't do all that. There was a reason why people needed to occupy and assemble in a place, a specific physical place. You can't do that online. Social movements can't do it any more than the industry can do it. I mean, after all, if everything were purely electronic nowadays, there wouldn't need to be a place like Silicon Valley or Silicon Alley that people could just disperse in the woods. You know, people actually want to see the faces and create themselves as a community. So I think that, some things are easier because of electronic communication, but the need to assemble, the need to actually, to use language of 1776, to consult for the common good. That was the rationale for freedom of assembly when it first cropped up in some of the state constitutions in 1776. The need to actually be there and constitute yourselves as a block of the people. This is, I think, an enduring need, whether it's the 18th or the 21st century.
Does there have to be the willingness to make sacrifice, to take risk, that it has to be more than just disagreement?
Absolutely. I mean, people, an activist is not somebody who simply expresses a view or a preference. We live in a society in which that's rather easy, isn't it? We can do so a mile a minute. What's necessary is to sort of invest your life. Now, that doesn't mean entail yourself on the spears of the other side. That means one has to find a way to do this inventively and creatively and actually to enjoy it as a way of life. I mean, if you can't relish it, then it's doomed. But you do also have to face the fact that, you know, this is not just a game, that there are real values at stake, there are people who won't like what you do. And, in fact, it's the measure of your seriousness that you're taken seriously by those who were repelled by you.
How much harder is it today, given all the accompanying noise that's out there?
I don't think it's ever easy. You know, when I first stumbled into activism, the conventional wisdom was that we were the silent generation. I was at the edge of it. I entered college in 1959. Nobody thought this, you know, there was any such thing as the 60s yet, and it wasn't all the rage to be a political activist. You know, you feel the imperative and you find a way to realize it on the landscape that exists. And sometimes things pay off in spades in ways you didn't expect, and sometimes they don't. The activist is not simply an opportunist who seizes upon an opportunity that throws itself open to you. It is somebody who probes, who is empirical, who is practical, pragmatic, who tries this and sees how it plays out, and if that doesn't work, tries something else. So activism is very much in the spirit of the probe, the experiment. In fact, let's say in the sense of science.
Right. Part of it is certainly political. How important is it that there be a moral imperative?
Oh, I think it's decisive. One of the hurdles in for any social movement is the cynicism that greets the idea that there can be ideals at play in the real world. The cynic is always is always the obstacle. Sometimes that's your own internal cynic as well. The activist is somebody who takes morality seriously and at the same time skirts one of the many pitfalls that is built into activism, namely moralism of a severe and self-righteous sort. It's a complicated business. You have, the moralist has to articulate a sense of better as opposed to worse, has to articulate what we call values, but without lording it over those who think otherwise. The activist is patient. The activist is at the same time urgent. And this is not easily done.
What about deciding how to work within the system? I mean, for example, we can look at the Tea Party right now, which on some levels has faded and on other levels has been very successful in election after election.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they faded. I mean, they now have their guy on the ballot, right. The Republican Party. Their public base ebbs and flows, as is the case with all movements. The movements on the right have a generally simpler time of it because they believe in power and they believe in hierarchy, including their own. So they roll up their sleeves, get it to work, and they take over the Republican Party, which in effect they've done. The left is more ambivalent about power and is reluctant to enter into those precincts where the danger of, as the Occupy movement was always putting it last year, co-optation seems to be the big yawning boogeyman confronting them at every turn. You live on a landscape which you did not make. And to take seriously the institutions that exist, including political parties, is simply a matter of responsibility. You know, if you go to the doctor with a certain problem, the doctor can't assign you a different, genome to operate with. I forget whose story it was about the guy who stops for directions and tells him where he wants to go, and the person he's talking to says, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here. You are starting from here, and here includes a whole lot of forces that you might wish didn't exist or have had some different configuration, but there they are. What we have is a calcified political system. So you have to address it, and if you abstain from it, then your purism actually stands in your way. We know very well what happened in 2000 when Mr. Nader viewed his own purity as a more urgent matter than defeating George Bush, and I don't have to regale you with the consequences.
To what extent does economic impact play a role? In other words, the role of economic conditions in either spurring or suppressing dissent and activist activity.
Well, we live on an economic landscape, but the economic facts play out in very different and not altogether predictable ways. Right now, for example, you have the tremendous anxiety about the economic future. You have the indebtedness of everybody, virtually everybody who's gone to school, gone to college. You have the vast unemployment. You have the foreclosure and mortgage-based pain that we've been subjected to in recent years. All this, does this make it easier? Does this make it more auspicious for social movement? Well, depending on how you play it, because economic suffering by itself can very easily be conducive to despair and a sense of stagnation. I would say we've been there for a long time. If you look at for 40 years now, the American income has been stagnant, except for the very top. The fact that people are suffering, that middle-class lives are becoming endangered, doesn't actually arouse people to a sense of stalwart resistance or intelligent opposition. It can just as easily drive them into apathy and disgruntlement, a sort of bitching, bitter, grumpy, couch potato operations. It's never the economic conditions that act by themselves. It's the activists who frame them, who shape them, who define them and redefine them, redescribe them in ways that are conducive to people feeling invigorated by the democratic possibilities.
And which brings it back around to this idea of object and the vision thing, to use an old tired phrase, and trying to figure out what, for example, here a 21st century economy should look like.
Well, I think that the danger, I think it's demonstrable that the great damage that was done to the global economy, not just the American economy, was done by irresponsible elites who served themselves, who dealt to each other's benefit in producing these mortgage-based securities and so on, which dragged the world economy into the dust. Democracy is not a foolproof cure for all problems, but it's certainly a disposition that ought to be pursued. And what I'm saying here clumsily is that the economy needs a whole injection of democratic involvement, and that again is the sense that was made by the Occupy movement in talking about, you know, the need to consult for the common good and to create means by which ordinary people can actually have a voice. The corporations right now act with impunity, and whether it's in funding the economic, funding the political system, or rigging the game of results in politics, the suppression of democracy is of the essence. And so, you know, the demand that people actually be represented in decisions that affect their lives, to paraphrase an old slogan of Students for a Democratic Society, this is of the essence. And I think it's, you know, it's not that difficult to explain that when affected interests step up and express themselves, then you tend to get better decisions. The German economy is the envy of the rest of the industrial world in no small part because the employees in a firm are represented in the governance of it.
Given the time you've spent looking at the Occupy movement today, do you think that young activists today are up to the challenges they face?
Well, I don't know. And you know what? To make things even more more interesting, we're not going to know for some time. I mean, there certainly are a great range of people in the Occupy movement. Some of them, I think, appreciate that they need to build more enduring networks and work out, you know, what I think of as a full-service movement that can be appealing to people who are zealous and have a lot of time on their hands, as well as people who are maybe also zealous but don't have a lot of time on their hands. So I've met people of all different sorts in the Occupy movement. Some of them are extremely serious and would agree about the need to move to a sort of 2.0 Occupy revival where the demands are more concrete and the strategies are more focused. Things are a lot of moving parts, and a lot of things are still in play. I don't know how it's going to play out.
Todd Gitlin, the book is Letters to a Young Activist. It's just out in paperback from Basic Books. Todd, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
My great pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.